in 2020, the beginning of COVID, this was around the early part of the year, 2020. If you recall, we were vaulting our gold in Switzerland, these private vaults in Switzerland. Well, the Swiss government grounded the airplanes. They said no one can take off, no one can land. So what this meant was I woke up in the middle of the night and I realized if one of my clients called me, one of my investors called me and they said, Alex, I want you to deliver $20 million in gold bars to this country over here in this vault over here, I could not do that because the planes couldn't take off. So this is what you call a failure to deliver in the gold industry. This is bad. It's not good. It's not good for your reputation. Granted, you could say it's because of COVID, but whatever. You still had a failure to deliver in gold. To have final settlement, you have to move the gold from one possession to another. Okay? This requires people. The guys at the vault, the guys on the trucks, security trucks, the ground crew, air crew, all these people. The same thing on the other side. And I realized, oh, any one of these people can mess this up. And then I thought about Bitcoin because I was studying Bitcoin at the time. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. With Bitcoin, I can send any amount of value to the other side of the planet basically instantly because it's going across the internet at the speed of light at almost no cost. No one can stop me. I need no one's permission. And I was like...
Hello guys, welcome once again to Bitcoiner Podcast. Today we have a very interesting episode. You'll find out why. But first, I just want to say that I hope that you have enjoyed the two-part series of the episode 100 of Bitcoiner Podcast. But it's not just me. As you can see, we also made this amazing episode with Bitcoin Film Fest, where we expose Hollywood. But again, we took so long to do this episode because we don't chase the news. So it was the topic, even we talk about Warner Bros. Deal with Paramount and Netflix. We wanted to digest why Hollywood's broken. And to do that, also, we needed to explore the monetary system. So we deep dive really into it a lot. So that's why we took a lot of time doing it. And now we are providing the solution how Bitcoin can help, especially independent creators or even filmmakers to help some issues, resolve some issues where the system is broken. But as you can tell in the first part, everything comes to the money, but more than beyond that, it comes to the system. But anyways, I hope that you enjoyed the second part this Friday, but we will continue today to something refreshing. And I know you know that I like to do both parts. So some episode in English, some episode in Spanish. This one, of course, is English. And I was doing some research more about gold. And more than that, keep digging why the system is broken. Because a few weeks ago, we had Lawrence Lepper, Larry, and he provided a huge insight, you know, about mostly the history of America and how we led to the present. So today we want to explore more. And I know this person is also a friend of Larry. And I have been personally following him from a couple months ago as well, because we provide a lot of insights also in gold and microeconomics. We want to keep learning. I'm just like you. I'm learning every single episode. But again, I don't want to take more time introducing this person. So I just want to welcome Alex Stansky to Bitcoiner Podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to you. So, yeah. Well, normally I like to start a podcast. Sometimes I forget and people tell me, hey, but you don't give it enough time to introduce your guest. So if you can share a little bit about your background before we start on this madness.
Sure. Okay. So I've had a number of different careers coming out of high school. I went in the U.S. military and I was deployed in Operation Desert Storm for that period of time in my life. When I got out of the military, I went into IT. I started a little IT company and did a bunch of IT consulting, did some consulting for like Verizon and some other companies. I ended up becoming a director of IT for the largest aerospace union in the United States. And then at the same time, we kind of made this little company on the side that we were creating. We were one of the first video over IP companies. Ours was decentralized though. This was around the time that YouTube was in alpha. So they're just testing this technology and it's still the pipes were not very big. So this was back when the internet was like, you know, very small, like 512K, maybe something like that bandwidth, like 1 megabyte bandwidth. I can remember when one megabyte
wow, that's bandwidth.
It's crazy, right? Like today, like my connection today is like a 1 gigabit, 1 gigabyte.
You cannot even compare how the technology.
It's unbelievable, the difference. But back then, you couldn't really do high fidelity video because the pipes were so small. You know, there was no bandwidth to do it. So we were actually doing decentralized video. The idea was kind of like a Napster or something like that, where the video was spread out across like hundreds of computers. And then if I want to watch it, I'm pulling video or pieces of data from all these different computers and it reassembles
on
my.
It took weeks, I remind.
Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy. Well, so, and we actually went to Netflix at one point. I remember we went to one of their executives and we showed them our demo of our technology. We said, hey, we think.
How old is Netflix? I want to know that.
I don't know. I'm not sure when they started, but when this was happening, I want to say this was around 2005, 2006 time frame.
Okay.
And maybe even a little, that time frame.
Okay.
And I can remember going in and showing it to them. And this was at the time Netflix, when they started, they were shipping DVDs in the mail of videos, right? And we showed them our technology and we said, look, we think that video eventually is going to go over the internet. People are just going to use it over the internet. They laughed at us. They laughed at us right out of the office. They're like, no way. We ship videos in the mail. We don't do that. Right. Yeah. Funny. We were just too early, basically. So I sold my position in that company. Ended up moving down to Central America, Panama. We were talking about this a little earlier. Panama, yeah. For almost a decade. I started in the gold business and I met some very interesting people who were in that industry and started learning from them. And I started a physical gold fund, two of them. The first one was out of Luxembourg. That was horrible. Pro tip, never start a gold fund in Luxembourg. The fees will kill you. So we closed that. We opened another one and that one ran for a long time and our investors did pretty good. Excuse me, but this was basically our physical operations were out of Switzerland. And it was during this period of time, actually, that I started researching Bitcoin more deeply. It was probably 2019 to 2020 timeframe when I started researching more deeply, going down the rabbit hole, as people say, talking to gold investors on the phone. And then hanging up the phone, and I open up a book on Bitcoin and I'm reading books on Bitcoin.
Same background.
So at this point, I'm starting to figure out, man, I'm spending all this time researching Bitcoin. At one point, I realized I need to switch. So then after that, towards the end of 2020, I talked to my partners in the gold fund. I was like, I need to wrap this up because I'm going to go work in Bitcoin. 2021. I started shortlisting companies. Well, I just knew. I was like, and we can get into that story as to why I made that decision, but I just knew that like this is the future. And so 2021, early 2021, I was shortlisting companies. I was like, I really want to work in this space. I think it was January of 2021. Corey Clipston, who's the CEO of Swan Bitcoin. I saw him tweet out one day. He's like, hey, we're looking for high net worth relationship managers. People can talk to high net worth people about Bitcoin. I'm like, hey, I can help you with that. I've got experience doing this kind of stuff. Not with Bitcoin, but in gold. And so we started a conversation. I was like, I think I can help you, you know? And turns out I talked to him for a couple of weeks. We had a couple of interviews, so on and so forth. And he's like, hey, I can't hire you because I hired Stefan Levera instead.
Wow, I didn't know this.
And I was like, you know, if it was me and I had to choose between Alex and Stefan Levera, I probably would have picked Stefan Levera as well, just being honest. I mean, he's an amazing guy. He's really smart. Shout out to Stefan. Anyway, I was persistent because I was like, you know, I just want to work in the industry. I just stayed in touch with Corey. And by the way, this is a lesson to people who, if you're interested in working in Bitcoin, number one, do something, teach something, start a meetup. Write a book, do pods, do something to help educate and push the mission forward. And if you do that and you create a footprint, if you go talk to a Bitcoin company and you can point to your proof of work, that is way better than having no proof of work.
Sure. Yeah.
So anyway, I just stayed in touch with Corey and eventually towards the end of the year, at one point, you know, I was just like, hey man, put me in coaching. He was like, okay, cool. So I started in October of 2021 with Swan. I worked with the private wealth group at Swan and stayed there for almost 4 years-ish. And in that period of time, helped thousands and thousands of clients, taught them about Bitcoin, helped them buy Bitcoin, helped them do self-custody, helped them do multi-sig, whatever it was they were looking to do. And probably $400-ish million worth of Bitcoin, converted US dollars into Bitcoin, which is today is worth probably close to $1 billion.
Yeah.
And then, so that's my story.
Wow, that's crazy. You know, that's something that I admire. And at the same time, I think like, because I was thinking as you had the same thing that I think about Larry, because you guys, I mean, you have been working with gold, so it's not like you're working with a few pennies, let's be honest. So in order to pivot to Bitcoin, you actually need to understand that, because in the end it's capital risk that you're doing, that you need to understand what you're doing. You, in the end, if you have a company, you'll make sure that all your clients or even your funds or your savings will be safe. So yeah, just as pivoting on Bitcoin, you need to do that, like a huge research about this, right? So it's crazy that the amount of time that people need to put to understand this. But once you understand the system, just start, like we were talking about at the beginning, just start opening a lot of rabbit holes and you start seeing that a lot of things are broken. So yeah, and those are the things that we're going to discuss. But also I want to ask you, like, because what I like to do in the podcast is like, you know, like a journey, like the previous, then the context, and then the resolution. So I want to ask you also about in your first days, like when do you personally first start buying like physical gold? What is your story with the gold?
So the story with the gold is that I grew up, I was going to high school in the late 80s, right? So to dating myself a little bit, but just to give context, at the time I was in school, like generally speaking, if a person could make a six-figure income, that was like, you were like rich. Like you were doing really, really well back then. That was a lot of money, right? So to put that in perspective, in today's dollars, that would probably be, I'm going to say 500K and up annually to have the same purchasing power, somewhere like that.
Okay.
So anyway, when I started making that kind of money working in IT, it was low six figures, but I'd breached that six-figure threshold. And I was so excited about that. I'm like, I've made it, right? And I'm like, I should be rich now. But I wasn't. And that was very confusing to me. I was like, how come, you know, shouldn't I have just piles of cash and like mansions and all the things right now? Not really, right? And it wasn't until when I had moved to Panama and I had met these guys that were in the gold industry. And just very late at night at my house, I remember we had this house. It was in this area called Veta Cruz, which is kind of, I guess it would be west of Panama City, okay, into the interior a little bit. We had a house overlooking the ocean.
That's
and
beautiful.
Kind of in the jungle, basically. And so very late at night, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, we're drinking wine, talking to these guys. And this one guy explained to me what causes inflation. It was basically, okay, the government of America can just print as much money as they want. And when you add money to the money supply, it causes the purchasing power of the individual units of money to go down. I had never heard this before. And that was like a, wait a minute, like we have to work for the money and they can just print it. And they're like, yeah. And I was like, that's messed up.
And this could be like, because it's super shocking that.
Yeah. Like, well, I believed it because it started to make sense. I was like, well, that explains why if you're now making 100 grand a year or whatever, you think you're going to be rich, but you're not, because it buys less and less and less and less as time goes on. So at a target rate of, I'll give you an example mathematically what that means for people who have not heard this before. You've heard the Fed chairman say, I'm talking about the Federal Reserve of the United States, say, yeah, that they target a 2% rate of inflation. What that really means is that every 35 to 50 years, I'm going to give it a span because it goes up and down. I'm just saying in that range, every 35 to 50 years, your purchasing power is cut in half. So by the time your retirement age, you can work your whole life, all the money that you saved up has half the purchasing power. They stole half your purchasing power through inflation. And that's starting me down this rabbit hole of understanding money. And just for probably the next, I don't know, 2, 3 years, 4 years straight, I just spent 6 to 8 hours a day just studying monetary history, monetary theory, so on and so forth. And this is really what got me into gold. I was like, holy crap, need to buy a bunch of gold. And that's what I did, by the way. I bought a bunch of gold. And this was right around 2008, you know, the whole real estate crash was starting to happen in the United States of America. I was calling all my friends back in the States saying, sell everything, buy gold. All that real estate you got, it's in deep trouble. Like, I was really early. Everybody thought I was crazy. But yeah, that's how I got into the gold industry.
Okay, that's crazy. I'm just thinking two things right now. One is that, well, first I'll give you, actually one is a comment and then another is a question. That I start having some insights, let's say, about inflation in the 2000s in El Salvador, because in 2001, we switched our currency. We had colones and then we had dollars. And the reason that the government explained that we were start adopting dollars is because we're starting to have some inflation, high inflation. So they say that eventually, probably we will have the same path that Argentina had with the Corralito, you know, super high inflation. So it was like a way to avoid that. And I remind that when we adopted the dollars. Back then, I was probably a teenager, so I started knowing a little bit about how money works, but of course not like now. But I just remind that families that normally work well, have their savings or whatever, they start struggling because back then the dollar worth 8.7 is the same thing that you say. It's like, imagine one day they say, hey, hold your savings, gonna be divided by 9. Yeah, so it was crazy. And I saw that even more with my grandparents or, you know, people from that generation that worked the entire life and now they're like, hey, but now their savings is cut by 9. So yeah, it was crazy. And little by little, eventually we just pivot to the dollars. But the other thing that you mentioned is about the 2%. That's something that I still quite don't understand because I have been doing some research about it. But when they do this calculation, they don't measure everything, right? They put some things. Oh, actually, better say that they don't take into account so many things when they do these calculations. And so in the end, that's a very fictional percentage, right?
Yes, it's absolutely made up. And they change it all the time. So if you go back to the 80s, they had a specific formula that they would use to measure inflation in the United States of America and certain rules around how this works. And I'm trying to think of the name. I don't know if there was a guy that used to run a website. I think it was called Shadow Stats.
Okay.
I don't know if that's still a thing or if he still runs it. But he tracked all of the changes in how they do the formula over time. So you can see, based upon the 1980s formula that they originally used, what the inflation would look like today. And it's very different than what the government's telling you. And here's the interesting thing. When you have governments with runaway inflation, they always lie about it. Just look around every country this has ever happened in. Just look at what the government is saying. They always underreport how bad the inflation is. And so in America, they just change the rules. They're like, okay, one day inflation means these things. And then, you know, X years later, it means something else completely. And they just keep changing it and changing and changing it to make the number seem lower than it actually is. Now, why would they do this? Some people would be like, oh, that just sounds crazy. Why would they have an incentive to do this? Why? Because there's thing called cost of living increase. There's a mathematical calculation that's used to determine how much they pay out in Social Security, how much they pay soldiers, how much they pay government workers. They have to pay based upon the rate of inflation. But if the rate of inflation is lower, they pay less, you see? So they're incentivized to lie about it. Either way, the point is, this is a mathematical concept called compounding, right? If you compound at 2% every single year, the net effect is much greater than if it was 2% one time. 2% doesn't sound like a lot, but if it's 2% 35 times or 50 times, that becomes a lot. Because of the way the math works, right? And that's the issue. That's why people do. And it's historically it has happened slow enough. Like if you look at the way compounding works on a graph, on a chart, it's very flat for a long, long time, maybe 30 years, and then it turns a corner. All compounding functions look like this, by the way. You can do this on any. I mean, compounding basically works where it's going flat, 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 flat. Then all of a sudden it turns and it goes straight up, and we're on the straight up part right now.
Yeah, actually, well, I want to ask of your opinion later about what's going on right now because it's crazy. But also one thing that Nadia, you mentioned, that yeah, why don't they teach this? Also, it's funny that when I start reading books about Bitcoin, I realized that because even I studied engineering, and I know most people, a lot of people that are in the audience here studied economy or something related to Bitcoin or money or whatever. I never learned about Austrian economics. It was until Bitcoin that I learned that there was more type of school of economy. I was like, what? What the fuck? Even in the university, I had a subject that it was economy. And I never learned about these things. So
yeah.
Why is Austrian?
There's a reason for that too. Like a lot of the economics courses today are driven from this sort of Keynesian kind of economic framework. And the Keynesian economic framework is essentially that, like, yeah, central banks should print the money. And then all of the economists, like the ultimate pinnacle of success, if you're an economist, is to be the chairman of the Federal Reserve or somewhere in the hierarchy, right? So what happens? Yeah. These guys design the curriculum, which goes to the colleges, and this is what you get taught. It doesn't mean it's right. They have an incentive. They have a reason to teach you what they want to teach you, right? And what people will find out if they study enough, or if they find enough really intelligent people, they will come to realize that a lot of the stuff you're taught in school is taught to keep you trapped in a certain system without questioning it, versus actually understanding what's really happening. It's very important. Yeah. It's like there's the set of education that the average people get, and then there's the set of education that the people who run the world get. Those are two different things. They learn two different things.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's crazy. No, I'm just thinking.
Did that, by the way. I just looked it up.
Okay.
2% annual rate of inflation, the half-life is 36 years.
Wow.
If it's 3.5, 20 years.
Wow.
If it's 4.5,
yeah, of course.
15 years. 15.75 years. Wow, so imagine if you're running 10% inflation.
It's crazy.
Which is actually, it's probably, being honest, probably closer to 10% inflation.
Wow.
So this is why young people, then the incomes don't keep up. Right. At least in the United States. I don't know how it is where you are or in Central America, but the incomes do not keep pace with the rate of inflation. So what does that mean? It means from the last four generations, this is why the youngest kids are today are looking at the house, the price of homes and things like that. And they're going, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to afford that. That's impossible. Math doesn't work. Well, it doesn't work because they have broken the money. The money's broken. And this is not new, by the way. This idea of broken money, this has been occurring over, and there's thousands and thousands of examples of it. Go study. I encourage anybody who's listening to this, go study the history of money. You'll see every fiat currency has one thing in common, all of them. You know what that thing is? They all go to zero eventually.
Of course.
Right. So what does that mean? It means that every now and then a country has to reset its currency. If it's fiat, if they're just printing it from a central bank, they'll have to reset the currency because they're all based upon debt. The whole system is based upon debt and fractional reserve banking. What does that mean? It means they have to keep adding money to the money supply. If they stop adding it and it goes the other way, that becomes deflationary. In a debt-based economy, you're now going to start imploding the whole capital structure. And this, they don't want this, right? So now it's at the point where, in the United States at least, it is a mathematical certainty, in my opinion. It's a mathematical certainty that this is now baked into the cake. It is the US dollar will continue to become worth less and less in an accelerated pathway moving forward. And so now more than ever, it's very important for people to get their economic energy out of the fiat currencies into something else.
Those things are, well, Bitcoin and gold, I think. Actually, I just remind something that I asked to Larry, and I want to know your opinion. So in his books, he exposed that the gold was manipulated by the government. So my question is that, do you think at some point Bitcoin can be also manipulated as the way the gold was manipulated back then? Well, and still?
I think yes and no. Yes, in that maybe short-term manipulation, but not long-term. By short-term, I mean very short time frame kind of price swings and sentiment. Sentiment can be manufactured. What is sentiment? Sentiment is general belief, right? What does the population, like, believe? You hear my puppy? Sorry about
that. Yeah, of course. No, don't worry. We're human people. We're with our family.
Yeah. Sentiment is what the human population believes in general, right? And it has been proven that we can create that. Like, Like if you look at like what they talk about at Davos, I'm trying to remember the guy's name, Harari. He's like the top kind of egghead guy talking about how you can basically manufacture belief systems through the use of social media and through the, this is not a secret. This has been going on for decades and decades and decades in the United States of America. They're just now, the world is just now changing because of social media. We can all talk to each other in real time, right? Instead of you get all your information from the newspaper or the university or the television station, right? We can now get it a completely different way. Well, they've essentially lost control of that, but they were still strong enough to manufacture a narrative. Think of this, what happened in 2020? They get the whole world to believe that there's this global pandemic. That was a created belief system. They created that. You follow? So I think in the short term, yeah. Like, and here's another example, maybe more practical for what we're talking about. In Wall Street, you know, there are people, old veteran traders on Wall Street who would tell you that they manufacture sentiment all the time. You know, if they're trying to get an equity to go up or down, they'll throw a certain amount of money at influencing the market. They'll start calling all their friends and creating rumors. They intentionally create these kind of sentiments, right? In the short term, it's really funny to me because I see sometimes, and I don't, it's been a long time since I've been in the gold industry, so I don't know if they're still doing this, but there are people who will say, well, the idea that gold and silver is manipulated is just crazy. You guys are a bunch of, you know, conspiracy theorists. And it's like, no, just look at the fines. The banks have been fined billions and billions of dollars for manipulating the price. That's not imaginary. It's not some guy making that up. It's not a conspiracy. There's fines, dozens of them, right? So the real question is, can they do that?
There's the data.
There's the data. I mean, yeah, it's like proven. This is not a, you know, this is not someone just going, we think they're bad. No, they're doing this stuff. Like, or they wouldn't be fined, right? They wouldn't pay the fines if it's certainly if there wasn't anything there. So, yeah, in the short term, they're definitely doing that kind of thing. In the long term, can they do it? I don't think so. And the reason why I don't think so is there's a big difference between gold and Bitcoin. With gold, you have to trust the people who are auditing everything, and you have to assume what they're saying is correct. Okay, so for example, with GLD, this is the largest gold ETF. They have a custodian, a primary custodian. They have audits of the gold. They have sub-custodians that can also hold the gold. They don't have access to whether those audits are, they have like a third-party audit. Does that make sense? So everybody's just trusting the word of everybody else.
Yeah.
It may be there, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. You got to trust that guy. Does that make sense? And then there's also big centralized kind of depositories for gold where they do a lot of lease lending and they do a lot of sort of rehypothecation of the assets and create all kinds of financial derivatives around these things. So there's a way that they can use that to kind of play games. I think it's much less likely with Bitcoin because the whole supply of Bitcoin is audited every 10 minutes. And it's not like you have to trust this auditor. These are humans, right? With Bitcoin, that's not the case. Any one of us can go look at the blockchain and can see. We know where all the Bitcoin is at any given moment of time. We may not know who owns that particular Bitcoin in that address. We can count the address. We know exactly how much there is. Does that make sense? So I think it would be far more difficult to pull the kind of games that they play with gold if they try to do that with Bitcoin.
Absolutely. This podcast is brought to you by Bull Bitcoin, the most trusted Bitcoin-only exchange.
built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners who give a damn about sovereignty. Not altcoins, no custody, just pure Bitcoin straight to your wallet. Get your own virtual event so banks can't spy on your Bitcoin activity. Buy Bitcoin instantly or send bank transfer to Canada, Europe, Mexico, and Argentina in a snap. For pennies, ditch the banks, screw the shady remittances apps. Head to boldbitcoin.com, use the code BitCornerPodcast, and start stacking sats in the right way, or send money home cheap and fast. Bold Bitcoin. Own your money, destroy fiat.
I'm just thinking, now that you say trust, and I just reminded that in the end, what happened with Fortnox? Now that you're there in the US, what happened to that? They didn't audit, right? And I think they won't do it.
No, I think you're right. I was just talking to someone else on another pod about this just the other day, where
okay,
the issue with Fort Knox is, so normally when you have vaults, okay, let's talk about the professional system of gold for just a minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
In the institutional trade in gold, there's this thing called the good delivery system. This consists of refineries. It consists of security companies that are moving the gold around, vaults, both private and bank vaults that store the gold. And they all know each other, and they're all part of an accredited system, the good delivery system. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the way it works is, the gold goes into the refinery. This is a good delivery certified or a good delivery accredited refinery, right? They melt the gold down. They purify the gold. You get gold bars out of it. They put a stamp on it with serial number, the mark from the refiner, the purity, all those things, right? Then the good delivery approved security company picks the gold up from the refinery, takes it to a vault that is a good delivery approved vault. This is what I call the good delivery chain of integrity. As long as it never leaves the system, we have a record of chain of custody. We know who handled the bars at all the time. Because every time the bars move from the, for example, from the refinery to the truck, they're signing off. They do an inventory. You have every bar, you have every serial number. They sign it off, right? We know these guys are carrying this gold. If something happens to the gold, we know those guys did it. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So it goes to the vault, same thing. It goes in the vault, they do an audit, they check all the bars, all the numbers, everything is legit, right? It goes in the vault. Sometimes what they'll do is they'll put it in the vault and then they seal the vault with a tamper-proof seal so that they know if that seal is ever broken, somebody went in there. So this is what they did in Fort Knox. They took all the bars from the refinery, put it in Fort Knox, they closed all the doors, each door has a seal. Many of these seals have not been opened since they put it in there. At least that's what it says on the seal. I haven't been in Fort Knox, but this is my understanding. So the issue that they're running into here is that you can look at a gold bar and say, yeah, I see a gold bar. It's right there. I picked it up. It feels heavy. I can weigh it. I know how many ounces it's supposed to be. It has a serial number. I can record that on a sheet of paper, all the thing. But the thing is, you can't be totally sure because it looks like gold, feels like gold, weighs like gold. The only way you actually know is if you put it back through the refinery and melt it.
Okay.
I mean, there's other ways. You can drill it, so on and so forth. But, I mean, if you really want to know, ounce for down to the 0.00 whatever of a troy ounce, you got to melt it, right? And so if you remember, Elon and Trump were like, yeah, let's count the gold bars. And then they started realizing what it would take to actually prove all of that. And they're like, nah, we're not going to do all that. I'm guessing that's what happened. I don't know for sure. I wasn't in the conversation, but I mean, at some point they realized this is not.
Yeah. If they didn't get it fast, there's must be a reason.
Yeah. Well, it's harder. It's harder than it sounds. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like to actually do it. Like some people are like, well, just go look at all the bars. Like, okay, you can do that, but is that really going to tell you? I don't know. Yeah. Someone's going to make the argument. Well, how do you know? You don't really know.
No, I just reminded that there was a video in the internet, like probably, I don't know, when was the last time that it was audited? Probably in the 80s, was around that they invited a few newspapers, journalists, and they went with a camera and they showed, but they just showed one bulb.
It wasn't a full audit, right? It was a partial audit.
Yeah, that's the one that I'm reminded right now.
Yeah.
And it was funny because they just showed one bulb. Yeah, exactly. But that's a very... I'm going to add it somehow in this video, guys, so you can watch it.
Fort Knox Depository was built in 1936. The last time a gold vault was opened for someone other than a Treasury Department official was in 1943 when President Franklin Roosevelt visited. Since then, many members of Congress have questioned whether there really is gold in Fort Knox. Today's tour by a 9-member congressional team headed by Illinois Republican Philip Crane and Kentucky Senator Dee Huddleston proved it. Crane originally suggested the trip. It takes 3 men, each with a different part of a combination, to open the door of the main vault. The door itself is 3 feet thick and weighs 20 tons. Down another hallway, the individual gold rooms are stacked with the bars running in numerical sequence.
So nobody actually knows, right? So there was a partial inspection in 1974, the one you mentioned.
Okay.
The last comprehensive audit was apparently 1953, physical count and verification. So what they did at that point is they pulled out the bars, they looked at them, they counted them, they verified them again. Do you know, right? I don't know.
Yeah. But now it's like 50 years.
This is part of the difficulty. Yeah, this is part of the difficulty when you're dealing with gold. There's two main difficulties. Number one is verification. Number two is settlement. Because settlement requires physical delivery. You can settle on the books. Like if I'm let's say I'm a bullion bank in London and I'm sitting on, I don't know, 500 tons of gold or 1,000 tons of gold or whatever it is. I can say, okay, this gold belongs to this client over here, but Juan's come to me and he says, I want to buy this gold. So we're going to transfer it to him. And I make a little entry in my book that says this gold now belongs to Juan. But it's still in my vault. You don't know if it's actually there. You're just going by me going, yeah, it's yours now. Look, I promise.
Yeah, but Bitcoin, you cannot do that because everyone has a copy of this.
And you know without a doubt, right? Like if I send Bitcoin to you, you're going to see it show up in your wallet at a specific address and you will know without a doubt that you have custody or control of that Bitcoin. It's not a question. You're not going to rely upon some other guy saying, I promise it's yours. Look right here. I wrote it in my book.
It just, we laugh, guy, because it's so silly. That's, I mean, it's crazy.
But I mean, humans did it for thousands of years. Well, at least hundreds of years as far as the modern banking era. But, you know, we were using gold way before that.
Yeah, it's crazy. Okay, I have my question. This is a very interesting conversation. But I told you and people know, we have a game in the podcast. So let's do it now to have a small break. So audience already know how it works. My previous guest have a question from my next guest. So yeah.
Pues mi pregunta es, ¿cuál es el mayor riesgo de Bitcoin? ¿Qué es lo que podría hacer que Bitcoin se destruya? O al menos la mayor complicación o el mayor reto que tiene Bitcoin para seguir creciendo, no solo en precios, sino en adopción, en crecimiento de todo lo que supone una mejor situación para Bitcoin. ¿Qué es lo que podría poner en peligro Bitcoin o qué es lo que tiene como reto Bitcoin para seguir creciendo?
What is the biggest risk? So several questions. These are good questions. Some people are very concerned about quantum as an attack vector on Bitcoin. I'm actually not. I don't really worry about quantum.
Why?
Because quantum is not mature. You know, it's one of those things where I call this the what if kind of thesis, right? Like what if someday in the future this thing happens? And it's kind of like you have to think about these kind of possibilities for purposes of establishing if there's actually a risk or not, but you also have to weigh the probability. In other words, there's a non-zero risk that if I walk out of my door, that a plane will fall out of the sky and hit me right in the face. That could happen. Very, very small chance of occurring, right? So the question is, do I operate my life based upon this tiny, tiny, tiny little risk? Or do I operate my life on the probability that that's not going to occur? Otherwise, I'm just going to stay in my house and hide every day. Does that make sense? So you have to look at it, things like this the same way. What is the probability that quantum is a risk? Today, zero. 10 years from now, maybe 5% or less. I just think we have a long, long way to go. And even if it starts to become a threat, what people need to realize is Bitcoin is like the weakest target. Why are you? Look, there's $900 trillion of assets in the world. If you have quantum that can break Bitcoin, you can break banking, you can break SSL, you can break nuclear launch codes, you can break government encryption, you can break all kinds of stuff that's worth way more than Bitcoin. If you were sitting there worried about Bitcoin, you got much bigger problems, right? But the last part of that is with Bitcoin, you can just change it to say we're going to make quantum resistant addresses, for example. And that's just an upgrade. So I'm not super worried about that part. I do worry sometimes that You know, maybe developers get influenced by powerful people. But at the end of the day, even that is not, if that is my biggest worry, I would say that, even that is not that bad, because Bitcoin is open source, right? You can choose to use a version of it or you can choose not to, right? How many Linux is open source? This is the thing that most people are familiar with, this operating system called Linux, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
How many versions of that are there? If you have one branch that's going a certain way and everybody's like, I don't like that, we're going to go with this one that makes sense, that is protecting us. It's really that simple. It's a matter of choice. So I don't worry about those things. What is important for adoption? What is important for adoption at this point, I think, is that Bitcoiners realize that people who are sovereign money minded make up a very small percentage of the population, maybe less than 2%. So if that is the case and we have reached adoption of somewhere like 1-2%, we might be close to saturating that addressable market. The rest of humanity doesn't necessarily think about Bitcoin that way. They don't worry about it necessarily, right? Inflation is not the driver. If that was true, well, everybody in Argentina would be using Bitcoin instead of Tether or whatever else they're using, right? So inflation is not necessarily the driver. Ease of use has got to be the driver. It's got to be simple. People have to be like, okay, just tell me this thing's going to work. When people get on an airplane, all they care about is the plane takes off and flies from A to B. They don't care how the engines work. They don't care about aerodynamic lift. They don't care about any of that stuff. They want to go in, sit down, put their seatbelt on, and they want to go to where they're trying to go. That's all they care about. Does it make sense? Mm-hmm. It's very similar. Human beings don't do things because they want to know everything and how it works. You get in your car, you drive. Do you need to know how the engine was designed? Do you care? Most people don't care.
No, I don't care.
So we have to understand that. We have to realize that where people are going to, we have to meet people where they are.
Yeah.
And accept their perspective. And if they want to learn, teach them for sure. But don't try to make them believe what you believe in order to use Bitcoin, because they're not going to be interested in that. So this is the adoption question. How do we reach this next segment? Is we need to make it easier. We need to show them, how does this help you? Because you can rant on about how the Federal Reserve is horrible all you like, but they probably don't care. When I got out of the military, I started a company, and this was at the time where the way you connect to the internet was to use the dial-up modem. I don't know if you maybe are too young. I don't know if you remember this, but it used to be when your computer connected to the internet, it actually connected to a phone line. It
had
a phone number. Beep, 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 beep.
Yeah.
And the computer on the other end would screech. It would make this screeching noise, sound like a fax machine. And then they would screech at each other for a minute, and then they would handshake, and now you have an internet connection, right? Nobody knew how to do that. So I had a company literally teaching people how to connect their computer to the internet. Do you know when the internet really took off? When like Comcast and Verizon, everybody made it simple. You just plug this thing in and turn it on. Boom, the internet went. Mass adoption, right?
Absolutely.
Just plug it in and turn it on.
True.
No configuring it, no like all the things, right? It just works.
Absolutely, that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
There was no thing as Wi-Fi even.
Right.
Yeah.
And nowadays, people just plug it in and it works. Maybe you have a little setup, but it's very simple. All of the technology, you're not configuring your DHCP servers, you're not configuring your gateway or your subnet or any of that stuff. That's all abstracted away. People don't even see that. Most people don't even know that stuff exists. They just use the internet, right? We got to get closer to that with Bitcoin. It's got to be simple.
Yeah. Absolutely. I also kept thinking that when Adrián made you the question about the risk and everything, I want to know what was the risk that you took into account when you pivot from gold to Bitcoin? Because probably you have needed to do like a huge analysis on it, right?
Yeah. So the two things that kept me away from Bitcoin for the longest time, the first one was that I thought the government would shut it down. I thought, you know, this is a potentially competing currency to the U.S. dollar. The U.S. government is going to shut it down. I heard about Bitcoin in 2011, and I didn't buy any of it because I thought the government was going to shut it down. I remember Max and Stacey talking about this. I'm looking at it. It's like a dollar. I'm like, yeah,
it's great.
That's not real. This is not real. The government's just going to shut it off. That was the first one. The second one was I thought there would just be another Bitcoin that was better. Right? I hear this still. Even today, I hear this all the time. These were the things that kept me away from it. I started studying Bitcoin at one point because I was confused as to why the government had not shut it down yet. This is in 2019. And after a couple hundred hours of looking at it and realizing that it's decentralized to the degree, it's been downloaded hundreds of thousands of times. It's on computers all around the world. It's on satellites, right? They're not stopping this thing. That's when I realized they can't shut it down, right? That's the first part. The second part is when I started looking at there's just going to be a better one. And when I realized that in order to overcome the current network effects of Bitcoin, it would be like you and me starting a company that defeats Amazon. We would have to have the same website, the same billions of products. We'd have to have all their data centers. We'd have to have their warehouses, their trucks, their planes, everything, all their robots, everything. And then we'd have to make it 10 times better to get everybody to leave Amazon and come to us. And that's never going to happen. I think that's the same with Bitcoin now. But it doesn't stop people from trying. People have made millions of altcoins, right? Every single one of them has failed to unseat Bitcoin. There's a reason for that. Bitcoin is the only one with no issuer. It's the only one that's truly neutral. It's the only one that nobody can stop. It's the only one that no one can control.
Crazy. It's crazy that, and when I think about this, it's like we realize that we're still early. I mean,
You
have been a few years. You have been a few years here, and also myself, but even now, it's too early. So, yeah.
It's that phase of time in the internet where people have all heard about the internet. People have heard about email. They're just not using it yet.
Exactly. There's one thing that I also talk with people that ask me about El Salvador, you know, and I say that even right now, it's not the gold tender. I think we had a few small success, but also I think one thing that I can give credit to Bukele by doing that, even he tried to do it, not from the grassroots, but from the bottom up to bottom, that's still one thing that he accomplished, is that at least people in El Salvador know the word Bitcoin. So now at least they can start asking, what is this, right? And I give a huge advantage because there's also people that actually, even they just don't know the existence of Bitcoin. And to start digging on it, first you need to realize that this thing exists. Absolutely. Last week we saw that I've been following some tweets about the having some Six Sigma. We have seen that everything was falling. Normally one thing falls, but the other things try to compensate, right? Mm-hmm. But in this case, we saw that the monetary system, I mean the fiat money, but also the stocks, the bonds, the commodities went down. So I want to know your opinion. What's going on?
I think this might be part of what Ray Dalio is talking about. And it's the very early days of it, I think, where Ray Dalio is basically saying that the global monetary order is changing. And this happens from time to time. There is a world reserve dominant currency, usually for a certain period of time, and then it's replaced. You know, this goes all the way back to the Roman Empire. It was the Roman Empire, and then it was the Byzantine Empire, so on and so forth. Eventually, it was England, and it was the British pound, immediately prior to the United States taking over those as the world reserve currencies. Essentially, it was 1944 at the Bretton Woods. This was right after World War II. World War II was wrapping up, and in 1944, all the world leaders got together. The United States at the time had more gold than anyone, and everyone agreed, we're going to use the dollar as the trade currency and the reserve currency, but you have to agree that the dollar is backed up by gold. And that was the agreement. You could turn the gold in, or you can turn the dollars in, we'll give you the gold. And this held for a very long time, right up until the late 60s. But what happened was that the United States was printing money, more money than was backed up by the gold. And eventually, the countries of the world started to figure out, hey, you guys keep printing all these dollars. Here's your dollars back. We want the gold, right? This led to the London Gold Pool. And eventually, it was essentially a run on the U.S. gold reserves. So there were all these redemptions occurring. The United States at one point was airlifting gold to London to satisfy the demand. And then later, as this continued with countries asking for redemption, it led to Nixon closing the gold window in 1971. And so if you think about that, that's 30 years, 50 years. The average lifespan of a world reserve currency is about 50 years. We're 55 years now. It's right about that time. So it's a fiat currency, and fiat currencies have a lifespan, usually. Like if they're managed well, like the US dollar was managed well for a really long time, I would argue. But Maybe not so much anymore. You know, it took the United States of America 200 years to print the first trillion. And now it's printing $1 trillion every 70 to 100 days. This is how fast they're going right now.
Great.
It is, right? So Ray Dalio basically says that this is, you know, there's one of these cycles where you have a major monetary reset of the global order. And I think that's what's happening. The countries of the world and the people of the world are starting to recognize that the United States dollar is caught in a debt trap. It is mathematically impossible at this point to stop the continued debasement of the dollar. Now, that doesn't mean the dollar is going to collapse. It doesn't mean we're going to stop using the dollar. What it means is they're going to keep printing, and the printing will probably accelerate over time, which means the inflation will continue to increase and probably accelerate over time. And eventually it starts to lead to these massive gyrations in the price. Can I share something on a screen for a second?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that will be helpful.
Let's see if I have this chart handy.
Yeah, it's super, super crazy. Well, while you look at it, guys, I invite you to look even for the story of the history of the World War II and then the Bretton Woods Agreement, because I think that's a really origin story to start understanding a lot of what's going on right now. For me, that was really mind-blowing when I studied that. Well, actually, I love stories about World War II because my dad is a fan of that. He always looked documentaries on it. But then once you start understanding more about money, it's like crazy how everything is connected so far since that period of time, I can say.
Right, so what you're looking at here is the price of gold in marks.
Okay.
Do you know what this is?
Saw that. Yeah, if you can explain it from myself. Yeah, I saw that. Okay. Larry reposted a few days ago. But so if you can give a context.
You're looking at a chart of the price of gold measured in Weimar marks. And people who study monetary history are familiar with the Weimar hyperinflation. This is where they had basically runaway hyperinflation. And as you can see in this chart, the volatility of the chart in the gold price continues to increase in amplitude massively over time. And the Weimar hyperinflation, you know, this wasn't an instant phenomenon. This took, in a 9-year period of time, the first 7 years was accelerating inflation. It wasn't hyperinflation. It was high inflation, 10, 12, 15, 18%, right? For like 7 years. And then the last 2 years, it went whoosh, straight up. And there was a lot of volatility as this was occurring. And when I saw the price of gold, here, there's another here's another chart that I would like to share. Let me stop sharing this one.
Yeah.
And I'm going to share this one.
I can see it, yeah.
You remember when gold was smoking, silver was smoking. Silver went all the way up to like 120-ish in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then this last weekend, it crashed. It wiped out $10 trillion of market value in 3 days. And for perspective, that's like 5 times the entire global market value of all of the Bitcoin. Gone. 5 times that amount gone in 3 days. So what does this look like? Is this reminding you of anything?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm not sitting here saying that the US dollar is going to into a hyperinflation. I don't really know. What I know is that these things tend to recur over history. We're definitely in a period of massive change. The world is looking at the United States dollar going, we may not be able to rely upon this for the next 10, 20 years. So we better start looking at alternatives now. China just came out and asked the world to start using the yuan as the world reserve currency. I don't know if people are going to do that, but this makes me very bullish on Bitcoin because I think the US has some runway here with stable coins. They're starting to use stable coins and that's going to extend the life of the dollar to some degree. But eventually, I think what will happen, and I don't know if this is 10 years out, 20 years out, whatever it is, but I think countries are going to start to realize that there's only one currency globally that's completely neutral, has no issuer. No one can stop you from using it. Nobody can prevent you from sending it across borders. They can't take it from you. And it's absolutely limited. And I think when central banks start to figure this out, this is going to sound crazy to some people, but I think they're going to start printing money and buying Bitcoin.
Oh, that could make sense. Yeah. Also, I just remind about I think there's a law, and correct me if I'm mistaken, that about cryptos, I talked this with a few months ago with Gary Leland. He explained me something that I think the law was really new. But basically what he tried to explain me, and I don't know in the end how this end up, was that the government was trying to acquire like XRP, I don't remember, some shitcoins or taxes about it. But the idea of getting that is to eventually, with that capital gains, to pivot it, sell it, and buy more Bitcoin to have it in the treasury of the US.
Yeah, possibly. So, well, when President Trump signed the executive order creating the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve, they created rules around that. And they basically said that the Bitcoin that's there, you can't sell it. If you acquire more Bitcoin in a budget neutral way, that's the language they used. If it's a budget neutral way, you can acquire more Bitcoin. That's fine. All of these other cryptocurrencies, if we have them, sell them. Mm-hmm. So that to me is a very clear signal. Like that tells you something about the way they view this stuff.
Okay, I didn't know that. Oh, okay, mm-hmm. Interesting. Because... And yeah, no, the other thing that I'm thinking is that now they say that probably that China says that invite nations to start using their currency as a reserve. I want to ask you, like, because now I have seen some strategies. For example, we started in El Salvador buying Bitcoin. Now the government is buying Bitcoin every single day, but also is buying gold when this thing happens, when gold is in sales. So my question will be like, thinking more in the global south where there's hyperinflation, what will be the exit way or the way to fix those hyperinflation? Like, is actually acquiring Bitcoin their treasuries or gold or both?
Perhaps both, yeah. I think in the interim, they'll acquire gold more. And eventually it starts to become obvious if there's peace globally, gold can work, okay? Because if you need to move the gold from one country to another, no problem. You just move it, right? If there's not peace, this becomes a problem. This is actually the reason I switched from gold to Bitcoin. Okay. So I'll back up and explain. In 2020, the beginning of COVID, this was around the early part of the year, 2020. If you recall, we were vaulting our gold in Switzerland, these private vaults in Switzerland. The Swiss government grounded the airplanes. They said, no one can take off, no one can land. Mm-hmm. So what this meant was I woke up in the middle of the night and I realized if one of my clients called me, one of my investors called me and they said, Alex, I want you to deliver $20 million in gold bars to this country over here and this vault over here, I could not do that because the planes couldn't take off. So this is what you call a failure to deliver in the gold industry. This is bad. It's not good. It's not good for your reputation. Granted, you could say it's because of COVID, but whatever. You still had a failure to deliver. In gold, to have final settlement, you have to move the gold from one possession to another. Okay. Yeah. This requires people. The guys at the vaults, the guys on the trucks, security trucks, the ground crew, air crew, all these people. The same thing on the other side. And I realized, oh, any one of these people can mess this up. And then I thought about Bitcoin because I was studying Bitcoin at the time. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. With Bitcoin, I can send any amount of value to the other side of the planet basically instantly because it's going across the internet at the speed of light at almost no cost. No one can stop me. I need no one's permission. And I was like, I knew with perfect clarity that Bitcoin was better money for moving massive amounts of value, right? Let's go back to gold for a minute. Central banks trust gold because if you look at interviews with central bankers after they get out of the central bank, they're no longer running the central bank, they will tell you gold is this reset button. Gold is like in danger, break glass, hit the button, right? That's how you reset the currency, is you must have a bunch of gold. So I think what you're going to see in the interim is they're going to keep buying gold to create basically a foundation. If they have to reset their money, they'll have the gold to do that. But this works in peacetime. It doesn't work in wartime. You remember World War II, when all those ships were going across the Atlantic, what were they doing? They were sinking them.
Yeah, of course.
To move gold, you have to put it on a ship or you have to put it on a plane. Ships can get sunk. Planes can get shot down. So if there's war, that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so I think what will happen is that eventually central banks will start to figure out Bitcoin, I can move any amount of value. It's a neutral asset with no issuer. No one controls the network. No one can control the network. No one can stop me. It's instant settlement. I don't have to worry about my plane getting shot down full of gold or my ship getting sunk. It's just logical to me that eventually they'll start to figure this out.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking, also I have a question because you say that you pivot to Bitcoin, but also you have your clients, and I'm not asking specifically about your clients. I mean, who they are or whatever, but the sense that they also need to understand Bitcoin in order to accept that you pivot to this, right? And so I'm just thinking like how right now that business work, because for example, let's say Peter Schiff, well, I have my opinion on thing. He is, you know, like pure gold, but I think he has some Bitcoin that somehow is suffocate, but he defends gold with, he dies in that hill, right? So, and I think he's not the only one. So yeah, like in general, how that work in order to say, hey, I cannot provide you. As the tester just said, like if there's war, probably I cannot deliver this in the case of COVID, but there is this superior money in order to understand that. I don't know if you follow me.
Yeah, well, you know, funds wrap up all the time and you don't need to actually explain why you're wrapping it up. You can just choose to wrap it up. You know, you liquidate the assets or you deliver in kind and you close the fund, right? Which is basically what we did. If, for example, a particular investor were to come to me and say, hey, Alex, what are you doing? Like, what are you interested in? I would explain to them, I think Bitcoin is a better asset and these are the reasons why. Now, will every investor agree with me? No. I mean, there's this concept called sunk cost bias. Sunk cost bias. What this means is if I've invested 30 years of my life or 40 years of my life in this particular industry or this particular asset, and I have all this money invested in it, and I have all this time invested in it, and I have ego and my professional image is invested in this thing, right? I can't easily give this up. My ego prevents me from doing it. My bias prevents me from doing it. But if you were to remove all the bias and simply say, look, from the perspective of what is just a better asset, what's a better form of money in every measurable way, aside from how long, right? Gold's been around a long time. I'll give it that. But aside from that, Bitcoin performs better. It's easier to move. It can't be confiscated from you if you secure it properly. You don't require permission. It's instant. And like the gold people like to say, okay, well, what if the internet goes away? Or what if the power goes away? And my answer to that is, well, it depends on what you're talking about. Is it a couple of days? Is it a week? Or is it like a year, right? If it's a couple of days, so what? If you're really worried about it, get a generator and a Starlink, just like everybody else, right? If it's a year and you have no power, you got bigger problems than whether you have gold or silver or Bitcoin. You know what I'm saying? You better need, there's other things you need to worry about. Like, how do you get fresh water? How do you grow food? How do you not freeze during the winter? Like, you need to figure that stuff out. And it's going to get very, humans get very weird very quickly when you turn the lights off for a long time. So I would say, don't worry about whether you have Bitcoin or gold. You better be able to protect yourself. You better have access to water and food. And it's like this whole argument is like, well, we're just going to be cavemen again. I don't think so. Humans don't go backwards in technology, not unless you completely reset, right? There have been situations where we've studied civilizations where their technology was lost. They were completely wiped off the map, right? Again, this is one of those tiny little probability scenarios. Am I going to model my life based upon this tiny little probability? Or is it more realistic that humanity just continues and our technology continues and our, you understand what I'm saying? Like, look, I was just looking at this thing with Elon Musk the other day. SpaceX just acquired XAI.
Yeah.
What does that mean? That means with Starship, when people don't follow this stuff, Starship is his new spacecraft. He can launch 150 to 200 tons of payload into orbit. He's looking at doing it 1,000 times a year. He's going to build a massive AI grid in space. No atmosphere, no terrestrial limits. Constant, continuous solar generation and compute. What do big AI clusters do when they're not using the compute for computing AI? A lot of them are mining Bitcoin. Why wouldn't you? I don't know if that's what's going to happen, but
yeah,
just some things to think about.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of rabbit holes. That's what fascinated me with this conversation, that opens a lot of rabbit holes, you know. But yeah, we continue. We can continue forever. Alex, we'll start wrap it up because I think we can go forever. And it's so fascinating what you're sharing. I just have a couple more questions for you. But one is like, well, talking about because I asked you the current scenario. So what do you think that is going to happen in the short term now that, let's say, now that we are recording February 4th? So in the next.
You mean in the price? With the price of Bitcoin?
Well, in everything. But yeah, in general. I mean, in macro perspective, because we have seen that everything is going falling apart. And also Bitcoin, of course.
I'm not so sure on the short term to medium term. I'm not very good at making these kind of like outlooks. I just, from a very zoomed out perspective, I do believe the global monetary system is changing, and I don't think it's going to go backwards in terms of changing. I think they may extend the life of the dollar, but ultimately it's still going in the same direction, and I think it will accelerate over time. So if that is the case, I mean, at the end of the day, there's like 900 trillion to a quadrillion US dollars worth of assets globally. We're talking stocks, bonds, real estate, art, all the things, right? Gold, silver, everything. You got to ask the question, why are people buying these things? And I believe the reason people buy these things is so that they're going to increase their purchasing power, their capital, over time, instead of keeping it in the currency. Like, if you could just keep your dollars or in whatever country you're in, that currency, if that currency increased in purchasing power by 10% every single year, would you buy all these other assets? A lot of people wouldn't. They would just keep the currency because it keeps going up in purchasing power. It goes down in purchasing power. That's why people buy all this other stuff. So my argument is that's a manipulation, because the natural state of a free market is deflation. If you listen to Jeff Booth, what does that mean? Is as technology improves, as humans get better and more productive and more efficient at doing things, the price of everything should fall. If the amount of currency remained steady, was the same amount, like you're not adding currency, the prices of everything should fall over time. I'm not talking about deflation of the money supply and deflation of credit, which would cause a deflationary collapse. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the prices of things should fall. We're not seeing that because it's just continuously inflating, right? So then the question becomes, all right, well, what's the best thing to buy? Gold, real estate, whatever. And Bitcoin is the only one that does not respond to human demand. So every other thing, whether it's gold, real estate, stocks, currency, if we want more of it, we make more of it. You want more houses, we build more houses. The price of gold goes up, we dig more gold out of the ground, right? Gold production is a function of cost of extraction. It costs money to extract the gold from the earth. If the price of gold is 8,000 or 10,000, maybe that justifies pulling the gold out of the ocean. If it's 20,000, maybe that justifies us pulling it from asteroids. You're never going to run out, though. They're just going to keep adding more and more and more and more. With Bitcoin, it doesn't respond to human demand. It will never go higher than 21 million. And if you start understanding the implications of that, the math is basically everything in the world that's worth something divided by 21 million forever. And that is the hardest thing, I think, about Bitcoin for people to really wrap their mind around. Because what that truly means is the purchasing of power of Bitcoin will go up probably faster than everything else forever. As long as humanity exists as a species, we will create more wealth. And as we create more wealth, the value of Bitcoin will increase forever.
Yeah. I remind that Jeff says when he came to the podcast, that it's fascinating. His thesis that everything will be repriced on Bitcoin.
It already is being repriced. Go back and look at the price of homes, look at the price of cars, look at the price of gold, look at the price of everything over the last 17 years in Bitcoin. It is already being repriced. Everything is. And in fact, the new incoming chairman of the Federal Reserve mentioned this in a recent interview. He said, what Bitcoin forces us to do is to be realistic about what's really happening. I'm paraphrasing his language. He didn't use those exact words. But because Bitcoin is a fixed amount, you can't mess with it in terms of understanding what it's measuring. If the price of everything is collapsing in Bitcoin, that is a clear signal for the first time in history, because it's the first time we've ever had something that was absolutely finite. It's the first time we could actually measure everything with a absolute finite measuring stick.
It's crazy. It's crazy, crazy. Yeah. We'll see if we go to... Do you believe that eventually we'll go to a Bitcoin standard so that we will... Bitcoin standard means that we'll measure everything in sats and we use it like as we use dollars.
Yes, but it may be abstracted. I think eventually the Bitcoin will be the base layer of the next monetary system. Gold was the base layer of the US dollar monetary system until we separated the link.
Yeah.
I think you're going to have competing monetary systems in the interim, but eventually Bitcoin will be base layer money, and then there will be derivatives on top of it, and you'll abstract it away. So will everything be measured in sats? Yes. Will people think about it that way? I don't know. We'll see. But at some point, from a perspective of how the monetary system is constructed, yes, everything will be measured in sats because the system will measure it in sats. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll give you an analogy. We're using the internet right now. We're sending data over the internet right now. We're downloading and we're uploading data simultaneously, right? Yeah. That can be measured. There's a certain number of packets. There's a certain amount of megabytes of bandwidth of data that's flowing, right? People don't think about that, though. All they know is that this works. Does that make sense? So I think the same thing, you'll see the same thing in Bitcoin. You're going to see, you'll still see fiat currencies. You'll see derivatives of Bitcoin. You're already starting to see it. When you see companies, treasury companies, that is a securitized wrapper around Bitcoin. They're creating wrappers in the wrappers now. You look at companies like Strategy now, they're creating preferred stocks. These are additional derivatives, right, that are acting like yield-bearing products. BlackRock just launched another derivative. So you're going to see layers and layers and layers that will abstract away what's happening underneath the hood. People won't know how the engine's running. People have no idea about the bandwidth and the packets that are flowing and all that. They don't care. All they know is they get on this thing, they talk to each other. That's all I care about. In the future, it will be like that, but the underlying system will be capitalized by Bitcoin.
That's an interesting point of view. And I never thought about it, but yeah. That's one thing that I'm always thinking, how everything will, I mean, how the world will adapt to Bitcoin. That's the better way to.
And by the way, I also think there will be plenty of people who use Bitcoin natively, right? Where that's just like sats over Lightning or through Fediments or something like that. Will the entire population do it that way? Probably not, actually. It'll be a percentage of the population that understands the technology that will do it that way.
Yeah.
And understands the benefits of doing it that way. Like, if, for example, if I get hurt by the centralized system, then I seek an alternative. If I don't get hurt, I don't even know it's a bad thing necessarily. Okay, my example, my case in point. There was an interview with Eric Trump. He's the son of Donald Trump. He runs all of Trump's businesses today. Right. At one point, he was on a television show. The interviewer was asking him, why are you guys doing all this Bitcoin stuff? Like, what's that all about? He goes, I'm going to paraphrase what he said. Why don't you try running a multinational business where you have to do a wire for $100 million and you find out your bank accounts, you've been debanked. Your bank accounts don't work anymore. He goes, that's why we're doing Bitcoin. Does that make sense? He got hurt by the centralized system to the point where he was like, I don't want to let them have control of that. I want control of that. So people who understand this are going to look for a solution to that problem. But if they don't ever get hurt by that, maybe they don't know. So there will be plenty of people that will use systems until they find a need for something else.
That's exactly the point. I think that people will start using Bitcoin based on that's a fascinating thing, that based on the needs that you have, because even I just popped to my mind right now, the thesis of Jason Lurie. He doesn't see it as a currency, right? He sees it as a way to protect that and to use it like, what is the term he uses? Like force power projection.
Force power projection. Yeah, economic force power projection. I mean, to put that into more simpler terms, if I'm the United States and I want to spend money for an international transaction, but all of my adversaries have cut me off, I can't send gold because we're at war. If I send a ship, they're going to sink it. If I send a plane, they're going to shoot it down. That makes sense? Or maybe we're being sanctioned. I'm not saying the U.S. is ever going to be sanctioned. Right now, the U.S. is the one doing the sanctioning. But you understand what I'm saying? But those kind of things work both ways, right? So I think what Lowry is saying is, what if there was this form of money that was neutral? No one could stop you from using it. Can you use that to project energy, economic energy, to a different place on the planet as needed without anybody stopping you? This is another rabbit hole, but it actually becomes, at some point, that becomes a strategic imperative, because there's only, I think the number is 200 million blocks a year.
Yeah.
Or two. I'd have to get with Bob Burnett. He's the CEO of Barefoot. There's a specific number of transactions available per year. And if you're not in one of those transactions, you're not doing what you need to do. So this is why I think it is probable that at some point, the nations of the world will be mining Bitcoin. Not necessarily because they're interested in having the Bitcoin, but more so that they can make sure that they can conduct a transaction when they want to. There's a lot of very smart people in the space who believe that, like, certain countries are already doing this.
Our country is doing it in a small way, but it's doing it. Also in the U.S., of course, Texas. Well, yeah.
Yeah, Russia, Bhutan. Russia, exactly. Like, there's lots of countries that are doing it now.
It's fascinating. Alex, we can continue forever, but I don't want to take much of your time. Maybe we can do a second part. But I want to thank you a lot for your time. It's so fascinating. I love these topics. It was the same with Larry. It was the same with Jeff. You open a lot of rabbit holes and we learn a lot. So thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to you. And just one thing, you also have a podcast, right? So let's invite people to go to your pod.
Sure. So my pod is the Bitcoin Crucible. You can follow me on Twitter at Alex Stanzik, just like my name is spelled here on the screen, at Alex Stanzik. And I post when we drop those episodes on Twitter.
All right. I'm going to share it also in the podcast notes. Once again, thank you. Guys, I hope that you have enjoyed this episode. Surely we'll have a second discussion with Alex. But yeah, thank you and see you next week. Ciao.